welcome back to yet another very exciting episode of the Friends Talking Fantasy podcast. If you like what you're... Oh, I'm starting to do the outro. We're so happy to be here, guys. I'm totally not confused by, you know, wrapping up our spoiler-free discussion of The Legacy of the Brightwatch by Crystal Matar. And now we're diving into the spoiler-filled discussion. Super excited to get into it. This was all part of our Friends Pitching Fantasy series. This is what Dylan pitched and I selected. Friends online, all you friends out there on the socials, clamored for us to give this book a shot over titans such as, you know, Scott Lynch and the Malazan series. And so we were like, okay, let's give it a shot. And here we are to dive right into it. But before we can do that, since this is a spoiler-filled episode, Dylan, you have some spoiler warnings to give out.
Yeah. If you haven't yet read The Legacy of the Brightwatch, we're going to spoil it moving forward, but you could go back and listen to our spoiler-free episode, which came out 2 days before this. And yeah, if you don't want to get into spoilers, now's a good time to turn this down in your headphones. By the way, for new listeners, to turn this down in your headphones thing, I mean, it can't hit as well as it used to, because for those of you who've tuned in more recently, haven't gone deep back into the catalog, we used to do this whole wacky intro where I'd be like listening to the music and I'd be like, turn this up in my headphones. And
yeah, we play about 30 seconds of the intro music. We used to play like a minute and a half. So it's like, maybe we should tone that down so we can get into the episodes, you know.
It was amateur hour.
Yeah, well, we had fun. But it makes sense now more than ever, because you used to say turn this up and I would never adjust the volume. And if anything, I would have turned it, I would fade it out shortly after you said that. So it just wasn't making sense across the board. I think it found a new home in the spoiler warnings of where it belongs. But, you know, today it's all about Crystal Matar and her work on The Legacy of the Brightwatch. Right, that's where we gotta discuss today. You know, we shared all of our spoiler free initial thoughts. We read the synopsis of the book. We praised the writing chops of Crystal Matar. We praised the character work, the theme development, and now we're here to really get in there with the details. Isn't that so?
That's exactly so, Charles. Where's the best place to start here, then? Because there's so many different elements at play in this book. We can start with the mystery. We can start with the steamy romance that makes Charles blush. We can start with the themes. I mean, where do you want to go first, Charles?
That is a great question. You know, I'm thinking, you know, we talk so positively about the characters and themes and things. I think we start in that direction. You know, I think we talk about some of our favorite parts of the book. And for me, I think you just have to start with the character of Tashiwe, because I think that is such a large part of this book. You know, we talked a little bit about the theme of, like, you know, you follow the law, but what if the law's wrong? Or what if the law betrays you? You know, and then at what point are you kind of complicit in some of these acts just by believing in authority, you know, and letting some of these things that you know are wrong happen in front of your eyes? And that all is done really well through, I said slice of life, and I'm starting to more and more believe that that's a kind of story, that this is the slice of life moments we get in the life of Tashiwe Blackwood.
Yes, every slice of life story has murdered, mutilated girls and life.
It's a non-conventional story. We said that, you know.
It is non-conventional, and I get what you're saying in the sense of, like, the focus is much more on the characters and what's going on at that time, and it's kind of, there's a willingness to sit with things that are not super focused on advancing the plot that you wouldn't see in something like a, like Brandon Sanderson is always the go-to for these like epic fantasies that are like everything that's happening in let's say Mistborn is serving the plot in some way.
And there's no like Sander Lynch at the end. There's no big reveals, betrayals, fight scenes. You know, there are some really good fight scenes, but it's not like an epic duel against two enemies. You know, it's very much like you said, Dylan, what I keep, for lack of a better phrase, calling slice of life. But it's like, yeah, the plot is these characters are going about their day to day. They're getting invited to dinners. They're, you know, meeting up for coffee. They're talking to toy makers on the streets. They're talking to reporters. They're investigating crimes, right? This is a long book, and the plot itself is not really the focus. So there's not too much there for a book of its size. And what you get instead is these moments with Tashiwe, and you start to, like, you know, it's when you have a character who's essentially a police officer, a detective, who follows the law to a T in a government that's so obviously, on someone, you know, from a bird's eye view, from the reader's perspective, is so obviously corrupt and horrible. Like, this world, the Dominion, sounds just like a horrible, horrible place to live. Just no value placed on human life at all. And totally like a dystopian nightmare. But for Tashiwe, it's like, the law is the guiding light of what I believe in, and I'm going to follow the law to the letter, even if it means imprisoning my own son. And you have to ask yourself, how could a character who's seen the worst of war and all this be so naive? And it makes for a really, really interesting, balanced character. What were your takes on this kind of balance between the naivete and the grizzled detective character?
That's well said, Charles. It makes him complex and nuanced, which is very important for character who's going to be carrying a lot of the weight of a character-centric book and a book that's going to be driving home themes through his experience. Clearly, the lessons were drilled into him at a very young age when he's thinking through that line that shows up in the summary. It's like, follow the law and... let me make sure I get the actual correct. It's like, follow the law and you'll be okay, right? That is the lesson that he has taken in. And I think that it's like we jump into his life at a point in which that has gone so astray. But we have to consider the fact that for a long time, it was what was getting him through a traumatic life, right? So for him to get through all these traumas of his, like the death of his mom, let's say, and the fact that like his mom was tainted, if I'm remembering correct, like a healer, and then she's killed, and obviously she was treated as a second-class citizen, if even a citizen at all, when she was alive. And it's like he's having to live through all this and make sense of it at a very young age. And it's almost like you have to believe that the law is in some way good, or it's just like too traumatic to understand as a child. And he's also a military man who obviously had his one moment where he went against the law and got whipped afterward. And you can say, oh, isn't that reason to be like, oh, I guess the law is absolutely corrupt? Sure, but it can also be reason to, just from a purely behaviorist, like, psychological standpoint, like, I followed the law really long as a military man and everything was going fine, and then there's punishment, like, they'd actually call it positive punishment.
What's interesting about that moment is that's the same moment that the same government uses to prop him up as a war hero now that he's politically interesting, right? So it's like, the hypocrisy in that one event about how they just use people. It's like, oh, you went against our authority. We don't care if you won the battle. You were supposed to die because we don't value your life at all. And now you've won and it's caused this problem, so you get whipped. You know, it's crazy. And on the other side, it's like, oh, you were such a war hero. Those people that whipped you were wrong. Like, you should be my mayoral running mate. You know, it's like the way they just use people in different ways. The same person, the same experience, all that matters is what works best for the government. And it takes Tashiwae so long to get there, even in this book, you know, so long to get to that point where he's like, I'm done with the badge. It's like the last couple chapters of this very long book.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely screaming at him from the reader perspective way before. All the other
characters are screaming at him too.
Yeah, that's true, and I think it's intentional. Like Crystal Matar, I believe, wants you screaming at Tashiwae, but sometimes we just have to learn lessons for ourselves by being beat over the head with this message over and over again. Tashiwae, obviously, a really hard-headed guy, and yeah, finally, it's gotten to him. And I think there's also this element of, okay, where is this naivety come from? Well, like Tashiwae is such a well-meaning person that it's like he wants to trust that other people are coming from the same perspective, like the lawmakers and all those folks. And yeah, it's finally been a perfect storm of the law is horrible. I mean, we also have the reveal of the mystery, which is that these children are basically being used as, like, batteries, I guess, is the best way to think
they
about it.
They break their minds and cut off their limbs to transport them and store them to use their tainted abilities as batteries for machines, like literally turning people into objects for industry.
And that's the way that I think we've talked about this before. We did a whole episode that's like, why do we love fantasy? That was way back, Charles. But a big thing that we touched on there is we get the opportunity through the addition of magic to like make real the like actualize some of these metaphorical ideas of like people being made into objects. Like that is kind of a more metaphorical thing in the way the real world that you can see
people. It's like when you recruit 18-year-olds to go fight a foreign war, it's like, how is that any different? You know, like obviously it's they're way younger kids and their bodies are being mutilated and this and that. But it brings home what a government is capable of and how it affects people who are part of the system that maybe aren't even directly turned into batteries, but they're still affected. You know, you see Tashiwae the whole time struggling to grab on to any kind of identity or belonging or structure in his life. The only thing he can rely on is his cigarillos, which he so desperately holds on to for every moment. But to me, like there were his early scenes with Stella, where his initial attraction to her in part comes from the fact that she knows a lot about his heritage, which was so squashed out of him from his early days as a kid, where his dad was out of the picture and you know, the mom was, you know, run into the ground by the government. And he didn't know things about, oh, these foreign lands and this whiskey and, oh, it must have come from this island. And, you know, that sense of belonging. And also, like, he never had a family because he was put into the breeding program. He never really had, like, the mother of his child in his life, you know. And so that was another part of it. And oh, I have a kid, Jason, and that gives me meaning. But then, you know, Jason becomes proven to be tainted and he has to, you know, wouldn't register. So he gets arrested and all these other things. Just this whole time he's running around grasping at stuff. And the thing he kind of lands on is the law. And the law was set up to be that for him as a way to manipulate him. And it's not until you go so far along with this character in that process that you can see what the shell of a person he's become, and he doesn't even realize it. You know, he got so bad to the point where he was like, I'm following the law. My kid didn't register. He's going to jail. Like, he did that. And then he meets with his son like every week or regularly, right? And frequently just watches him get beat up and just living in jail. And he's like, well, just register, Jason. Come on, like, just register. And Jason's like, dude, don't you get it? Like, that's how they control us. I have this moral objection, and I'm not going to compromise that just so I can get out of jail. You know, and it's an interesting dynamic that permeates the whole book, is Tashaway's sense of belonging. And that, with his sympathy towards children also, I think is a really interesting mm-hmm. tool, just to kind of put him at odds with the government, but also keep him aligned with it for so long.
That's well said, Charles. Yeah, from the very beginning of the book, I think one of the first scenes of Tashaway is he shows up at the pub, I think, and there's a baby there, and the baby's crying.
Oh, right. He soothes the baby, yeah.
Yeah, that's like the first scene, basically. So
right, I forgot about that.
Yeah, our acquaintance to Tashaway is someone who is very loving when it comes to children, has a gift when it comes to like soothing and nurturing children, and also like has this kind of vulnerable side to him that he's willing to show, like not traditional for such a buff war hero guy. Like he's also like, oh, don't worry, like I can coddle a baby too. Like has a willingness to show some of the more like traditionally feminine traits. So the
sentimental side in a society that is not sentimental at all,
for sure. So he's showing up with that, and that's part of why Crystal Matar's choice to use what's going on with these children as the impetus for change, like the catalyst that finally pushes Tashaway over the edge. I mean, coupled with his relationship with Stella and, of course, Stella's adopted child, we're getting like perfect storm, as I said earlier, for all right, finally Tashaway has been pushed over the edge between all these things. It's very well done in terms of a slow burn of the plot. And I would say there's also a slow burn, Charles, when it comes to the romance. We have Tashaway interacting with Stella from the start. And what's part of what's interesting is he pretty much has feelings for her right away. We also get her point of view, and she pretty much has feelings for Tashaway right away, which is, I think, relatively atypical when it comes to these romantic-y type novels. Like, usually they're much more likely to go from the like enemies to lovers. Like, I just hate him so much. Like, I think we've seen that in the times that we've read romanticity on this show way more commonly than we've seen like, oh, right away, I'm just like, oh, they seem really nice and I'm into them. And where the tension comes from, rather than the will they, won't they of like, do they even like each other? Instead, the tension comes from the power dynamic and whether or not Tashaway would be willing to violate that power dynamic he has over Stella by nature of being her regulation officer. So it's much more in that realm rather than the like the
courting. For sure. And just being someone with the tin badge, right, or the bronze badge where he gets promoted. But it's one of those things where it's like just by nature of even being in law enforcement makes you at odds with what we learned about Stella by the end, was that she was a runaway fugitive, like with a false name, and you know, trying to protect a kid that she essentially stowed away with. And yeah, it just puts her at odds from the beginning. So it's kind of a different way, like you said, Dylan. They're not enemies to lovers. They always had a spark and a connection, but their situation put them at odds for so long. And even when Tashiwe showed a sentimental connection to children and showed to be loving and tender and good intentioned, just by being a part of the system as a police officer equivalent, I forget what his actual job title is.
Regulation officer.
Regulation, just in, by being a regulation officer puts him as an enemy to most people. So it's kind of interesting to see. And I even think their names are opposite, right? Isn't Stella's last name White Rock? So you have White Rock and Blackwood. It's like not too, like, it's like, well, it's
a fake name, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still like, it just happens to be the exact opposite of Tashiwe's last name. So it's, you know, it's interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah, it's well said by you describing the ways in which, like, they're enemies to lovers on paper, and mm-hmm. not on the literal paper of the book, but right. like, in theory, a regulation officer and the tainted that he is in charge of have an adversarial.
Fugitive tainted on the run, too.
Right, who's hiding. Who's hiding the fact run, that, yeah, like, she's also hiding what her level of tainted ability is. Like, yes. I forget the name of it, but she's basically a, like, palliative care, like, hospice person who is, like, saying that her talent is the, like, oh, I can soothe people's pain as they are approaching death.
Right. And but instead, she's really, like, a healer.
She's a healer. Which eventually they kind of catch on to because she just can't help herself from healing people. And then, like, she's all like her patients miracles. Are, right, like, it just so happens that all of Stella's patients are making these miraculous recoveries, but no right. one else's are. But, right. yeah, they do catch on to her eventually. So she has all of these things to lose. And probably most of all, what she has to lose is that her daughter is not her biological daughter. And like you said, is someone that she saved and basically would be getting used in the battery way, I believe, if
right.
she were found. So it's a lot going on when it comes to things Stella has to lose. And she's taking a risk by getting close to Tashiwe and letting him in. So what did you think, Charles? Did you like this approach to the romance more than the more typical, like, Emmys to lovers? Like, I just hate him, and then, oh, maybe I'm coming to be attracted to him.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Like,
that. Because it's interesting, because we talked about how this doesn't necessarily adhere to any one genre specifically. When you think about the romanticy, one of the things that kind of surprised me when we were talking in preparation for this episode and in reading other people's reviews and whatnot, like, the romance between Tashiwe and Stella drive a lot of the positive reviews. And I was like, I didn't think of this as necessarily a romantic book. It's like, yeah, there's, like, you know, detailed sex scenes and all of that, and it's steamy. But
that make you blush.
Oh, like a schoolgirl.
Oh, he's blushing again.
But, what I liked about it was, you know, we've read other romanticy. Like, we read Court of Thorns and Roses, and that is set up as a romanticy novel. And there's some things that you can be like, okay, I'm not the target audience for this. I'm rolling my eyes a little bit where it's like, I did these horrible things because I loved you. And you're like, ugh, like, I don't really know how I feel about this. But in this, it was just such a natural, like, part of this world that they're in. It's like, hey, here's two people that like each other, but their circumstances are causing them to be secretive and at odds with each other. And, you know, Tashiwe has that relationship with, what's her name, Alana, at the court.
Leia. I-L-L-E-A, right? Alea.
Something like that. And, you know, she knows, and Stella knows about it. And it's like, oh, well, we couldn't possibly date. And it wasn't like a cheating thing like that. Blah, blah, blah. So it's like all that stuff is happening, but it's in this depressing world, and it's so oppressive, and they're just trying to survive, but they can't help but form this bond anyway. And to me, that's just a really powerful connection, and it speaks to her, to Crystal's ability to do character work as a way that services the themes, you know, because the themes are more about like oppression and like, when does the law, you know, when does following the law become immoral? And, you know, and so when you have those themes driving your relationship more than just like, oh, here's two steamy people being as steamy as possible until they finally get together, so much tension. It's like, that's not the case here. I mean, yeah, there's some sexual tension where it's like, oh, they kissed, oh my goodness, but it's not overly sexually charged until they do ultimately become a couple. But you know, I prefer it, you know. I'm always, when it's in service to the character development and the thematic developments, I'm always in favor of it. And that was very clearly a focus for this book. So overall, I ship it, man. I ship it.
Well, Charles ships it, and I think that's what's most important.
Well no, said.
You make total sense. I kind of depart from you is I see the romance as maybe it's really that and the mystery are right up against each other in terms of like tied for what the most like present element of this is. Like I did see it as a romantic book, and I do believe you're more in the minority than me here, which you kind of got at by saying that a lot of the reviews are focused on the romance between Tashue and Stella. But I agree with your point about it's almost the realistic nature of the way the romance kind of plays out makes it not feel as much like a romanticy, shouldn't be the case. Romanticy should definitely like have the range of being kind of more silly and campy to being super realistic.
I'm not the muscly prince lord of fairies with a huge castle and tons of money. And you're not the young, plucky, humble beginnings innocent person, right? They're two fully grown adults with like mundane entry level lives wrapped in government conspiracy, you know? So it's like that premise alone totally shifts it.
Yeah, but I mean, to me, romanticy ranges from each of those extremes.
Totally.
But it does, because kind of in, it's easy in your head, and for me too, to be like, what are examples of romanticy novels? And it is like A Court of Thorns and Roses, Fourth Wing, and those fall much more toward that opposite end of the pole that you're talking about in terms of, you know, fairy, the fairy prince. He wasn't a prince, but, you know.
Noble, well, at least. And yeah, sure. Sparkly.
Well, I guess it depends.
Buff.
We won't get too much into the A Court of Thorns and Roses discussion right now. But point being, that sort of new adult genre of it is what comes to mind. But these are like two mature individuals trying to handle a very delicate situation. And they're not just completely falling into that head over heels, love conquers all element of, they're like, no, like I have very serious commitments. Like for Tashue, it's like, I have a very serious commitment to my son, and that is gonna have to take priority, even if I don't want it to. Like my and heart in the beginning, says, the law. Yeah, in the beginning, the law, but by the end, he's still begrudgingly choosing to do what's right by his son over what's right by his relationship with Stella, which is like a super noble, mature choice that you see more likely among someone who's older and has more ties that are holding them to like to make those kind of tough decisions. And then Stella, like she's choosing, is it Ketrickin? I've been trying to remember the name of the daughter for Ketrickin. A while, but Point being, she's like, I have a duty to my daughter that's going to be taking priority over everything else. Ketrick, that might be another character in another book, and this just sounds like it. But point being, people know the character I'm talking about, and they know that Stella would choose that character over anything to do with her relationship with Caradwen.
Yes, Ketrickin, I think, is a character.
I think Ketrickin is a character in another novel. I just can't think of.
Ketrickin sounds so familiar, too.
Doesn't it? But
yeah, Ketrickin. It does. Oh, Robin Hobb. It's the princess of the Mountain Kingdom.
Okay, betrothed yes.
In Robin Hobb's books.
I think you just spoiled. I think you just spoiled something.
I did. I'll have to cut that out. For those of you witnessing a cut right now, I just dropped a huge Robin Hobb spoiler by accident.
Is it huge? I don't know if it's actually.
No, it's totally that, like, not, but it's just funny.
If I read the Farseer trilogy knowing what you just said, I don't think my enjoyment of the books would be altered at all. So
no,
but anyway, totally it's another not. That's another conversation. So yes, Charles,
she's a character in Robin Hobb's work that we read recently.
My brain could not process two characters.
Not to be confused with Caradwen, the yes. child of Stella Whiterock in The Legacy of the Brightwatch.
It was tough for me.
Well, the thing is, you said it, and I was like, that sounds right. You know, like, I believed it. And then I was like, wait a second. Like, now your doubting is making me doubt. And then, yeah, we got back to it. We got back to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, point being, it's the romance is interesting, different than what we typically think as romantasy novels. I don't know. I've never really seen this characterized as romantasy, like strictly speaking. Like, people aren't thinking that, but I guess they think of it more like it's gaslamp fantasy with like steamy romance elements. That's a little bit more what you'll hear. But you'll also hear, Charles, grimdark. And we've hinted at this before in this episode and in the spoiler-free episode. I would not have independently called this a grimdark novel. And we consider ourselves grimdark connoisseurs to some degree, Charles, because we're huge Joe Abercrombie fans. We're huge fans of Mark Lawrence, who has some grimdark work, some not grimdark work, and plenty more grimdark under our belt. So, Charles, what do you think? Would you call this grimdark yourself? I mean, it's arbitrary and independent, you know.
What I come back to is, if I was going into this expecting a grimdark story, and it's like, oh, this is a great grimdark novel, I would probably be set up for disappointment. Right, because yes, it takes place in this dystopian world, and there is violence, like he does torture people, and there is gruesome details about joints popping and torturing and blood and guts and shooting people in the head and all this other stuff, and the government is definitely amoral for sure, which is another huge thing, but it's not like there's all these conspiracies and betrayals, and all of our main characters are super nice and hopeful and guiding lights of morality that are trying to just be in love and have a family in a world that's working against them just because of the nature of how dystopian the world is. So is every fantasy book where government equals bad a grimdark book? Like, I don't think so. You know, there's no strict definition of grimdark, but to me it's like there's political fascinations, you have morally gray characters, betrayals, twists and turns, like all of that gray morality, which these characters, like you said, they're lawful good, or at least our buddy Tashue is. Tashue. And it's that goodness that to me moves it away from the grimdark category. It's close, but it's not a traditional grimdark experience that you're used to with some of the tentpole grimdark series, like, you know, Mark Lawrence's Broken Empire, First Law, Game of Thrones. Like, it's not any of those things.
Yeah, that's well said, Charles, and I pretty much see it through the same lens. I'd also say in grimdark novels, you generally don't get these, I guess, like, you don't get very clear positive resolution of themes. And by that, I mean, yeah, sure. Does Tashue get arrested, or is he about to get arrested by the end of the book? So there's a little bit of that element of, like, no good deed goes unpunished sort of stuff going on. But it doesn't feel super strong in the way you might see in an Abercrombie book. And super strong in terms of the grimdark elements. Not saying that it's weak right. In terms of the writing, but you see Tashue, like, what is the lesson that Tashue really needs to learn? And it's kind of like, government is bad and people are being oppressed and you need to stop being complacent and rally against it. And then he, like, learns it, you know? And there's no reason to think that he's
like
going to
go back to... Like, he quits his job and, like, verbally harasses the governor and, like, tries to break Jason out. And he does... break bad a little bit, torturing a guy for a mobster, you know, like, he does descend into some of that, and he you know, that's kind of shoehorned at the end of, like, oh, am I just using this as an excuse for violence? It's like, no, you're not, dude. Like, I you obviously love your family and you're doing what you have to get them safe quickly. You know, violence is sometimes the answer in those cases, especially when you're in defense mode. So, yeah, some of him's like, am I doing this because I'm a violent person that loves violence? It's like, no. But I respect that you ask. And just by the fact that you're asking that, it's like something that maybe Logan Ninefingers with 20 years of therapy might ask himself. You know, it's the same thing. Where it's just like, am I doing this because I like violence? You know, or something. Like, you had no therapy at all.
Logan
ready to
asks
go.
Himself those questions, but I think the answer in a lot of
the lack of nihilism.
Novels,
it's the lack of, like, nihilism.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of grimdark novels, if you're asking yourself the question of, like, am I just using this as an excuse for violence? Like, the answer is yes. And in this novel, the answer is no.
Yeah.
So,
like, if this was grimdark, he would, like, who knows what, like, arrest Stella or something, you know, like, or who knows. But,
and Stella kind of gets away as well. So it's, there's just a lot of,
optimism.
Understand the why people would gravitate toward the grimdark label for this. And I would say there are certainly grimdark elements to it.
Yes.
And I mean, we're talking about a book with, like, children being mutilated and, like, breeding just for the purpose of using them as batteries. Like, that's
breeding
pretty
programs, arresting people for not registering, manipulating Tashue for political gain. Like, all of these things would be in a grimdark novel for sure.
Yeah. But then there are those other aspects we talked about in terms of the optimism, in terms of the theme, in terms of the characters, the main characters feeling like they are good underneath it all and not pretending they're good when they're actually bad or anything like that. So for me, when I'm recommending this book in the future, I might say grimdark elements, but I wouldn't say, like, check out this awesome grimdark novel. And I'm going to go much quicker toward the mystery, toward the romance, and toward the just awesome, unique voice and writing as reasons to check this out.
Right. And I would agree. And I would recommend this book as well. The tough thing for me, and, you know, we're late enough in the episode that I can give my one tiny criticism.
You can't put that in the front.
No. You can't put it at the end either. It's got to be, like, right somewhere deep into the episode, right? We're all friends here now. We're listening deep into the episode. Like, I've recommended it in the spoiler-free. I enjoyed the series. I have nothing but admiration for Crystal Matar's work. This is a small thing. And that's all around the plot of the book and the ending. Because for me, it's like, there's so much great character work, there's so much great thematic development, but when you're, like, trying to put this into a genre, you kind of get a little lost. And I think a part of that is this plot ultimately doesn't go anywhere that far, considering its page length. Like, so much stuff happens. But when you're like, what is this book about? It's like Tashaway, like, falls in love with this woman, Stella. He learns about, he becomes disillusioned from the government. He quits his job. But it's like, so what, you know? Like, to me, I think I was missing some sort of more definitive ending. Like, I remember getting to the very end of this book, and I'm like, I still feel like we're in the middle of the plot, but I'm on the last couple pages here. And then at the very end, it's like, oh, all of a sudden police show up. Tashua, you're under arrest. The end. And I'm like, what happened? Like, can't we do a little bit more with the ending? Can we juice it a little bit? You know, we hinted so much at their latent powers too. Can we get a little bit of that maybe? Like, I don't know. Something a little more of a climactic ending. I just don't think we got. And I just think overall, if I was going to pick something that was a little weaker compared to everything else, it would be the plot. And I don't know if you felt that way, Dylan, but that was my one light criticism, because we get so much great character work. But for me, I was like, man, if we edited this a little bit and had that rising action and maybe a little bit of a Sander Lynch moment and then ended it, would have been so much better. So much better.
Yeah, no, I see where you're coming from. I think that the character work was much stronger than the plot. I think there's some degree to which that's a bug or a feature, yeah, that the fair plot is slow moving in fair service of the character work. That is up to the individual reader. I did not come away from this being like, there's a reason we've said so many positive words about this without ever yet using the word pacing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. So when we talk about, let's say, Sara El Arifi's The Final Strife, right? Mm. One of the things we're quickest to talk about, and that has incredible character work and all that stuff too, is, and the pacing. Like, our go-to thing is how we got E arcs of it. So we're reading the ebook of it, and it was before it came out, so it's a little bit of a different version of it, and we didn't really know what the page length was. And yeah, then when when we'd both finished and we're preparing for our interview with Sara, I just happened to be looking at the Wikipedia or whatever it was, the Goodreads of The Final Strife, and I was like, let me find the page length now. I was like, 640 pages in hardcover? And I like immediately I texted you and I was like,
was it that long?
Like, did you know that this book was 640 pages? And both of us were like, dude, I thought it was like 400 with how like quick this moved and how it's like constant action. Yeah. So it boom, feels boom, boom, super boom, boom, quick.
Yeah, it moves.
Yeah. So pacing is not the greatest strength of this novel, but there's also an emphasis on those little moments and that what you were touching on when you said slice of life, which is it's easy to see. It's kind of like this book, it's like a stew, you know, it's got all these little different elements in it mixed together, and slice of life is one of the ingredients. It's subtle. It's like you taste it if you have a very refined palate, like you do, of course, Charles, when you're reading this book. Now you like it because I'm complimenting you. But
yes, it's, and we're like, talking about food also. I'm following.
Yeah, it's perfect. Compliments and food. Charles needs both in equal measure to survive. But
yes, food metaphors always work.
But you get a little taste of it and you're like, is that is that a little slice of life in there? And you ask the author, exactly. And they're like, I did throw a little bit in there. Like, thank you for noticing. Like, not everyone sees that. Like, sure.
Yeah.
Is there slice of life in here? Yes, because there's those little moments that are allowed to breathe in a way that a book that had more, like, fast pacing just isn't going to have. So that can be a feature, especially when folks are super invested in the romance. Sure. It's like,
remember when we read Robin Hobb, and it's the same thing. It's like, what, like, the plot that happens in this book is not the feature. It's spending the intimate extended time in Fitz's head, the character work that Robin Hobb does with Fitz. You can equate that to what we're getting here. There's a bit more structure around the story here, I would say. But, I mean, it's the same kind of approach where there's just shift in priorities. For me, like, I think the sequel potential that this book was obviously trying to build up to kind of took away from the ending of this book as a standalone work. That's my only very minor thing. And like you said, Dylan, is it a bug or a feature depending on who you ask? And not to take away from Crystal Matar's incredible writing chops. To me, like, the person who reads too many fantasy books at once and shares his opinion all the time, like, if it went through one more round of editing, like, it could have been so powerful and, like, add a little bit of suspense or action or something at the end, a twist or something, a reveal, whatever. Like, this book is full of them, and so many of them are latent throughout. And, like, she sets up so many wonderful things with these latent abilities and like, just all these potential enemies and in the politics and things like that. And just the hypocrisy that this government is capable of is so ripe and juicy for these kind of moments. We didn't really get one. Like, the juiciest thing is that he gets arrested for raising his voice to the governor, and you're like, okay. Like, he's on, like, the last line is, you're under arrest, and I'm like, okay. Like, what am I supposed to do with that as a line, you know, at the end of your book? Like, what am I supposed to do with that? And I guess as someone that just wants more, you know, effective hook at least, but give me a little something, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I think that it's kind of like how we recommend The Blade itself, Joe Abercrombie's first book. And it's like, well, if I remember, I read it at the same time as the first book in a series called the Akasha Trilogy. Mm-hmm. And I did enjoy the Akasha Trilogy as well. And it's a good recommendation for people who are big fans of Game of Thrones, because there's a lot of, I think, Game of Thrones inspiration there. But anyway, point being, I read these both a long time ago, and I remember saying to you afterward, far before Friends Like a Fantasy existed, I was like, dude, you know, if you looked at the Wikipedia pages for both of these novels I just read, like, mm-hmm. in a summary, like, what happens in the first law and what happens in the Akasha Trilogy, you'd be like, holy crap. Like, the Akasha Trilogy's first book, I think it's just called Akasha or something, it is probably so much better than, so much more entertaining, because all of this wacky stuff, like, intense twists, all this stuff is happening. And then it's like, if you read The Blade itself, it's like, did anything happen in this book at all?
So true.
And I'm like, I don't think you'd read First Law yet at that point. And I was like, dude, but please read The Blade itself, because it is so much better than the other book, like, to be frank. And it's like a, you know, five stars, like, feels like wish you could give it 6-star rating is our opinion on, like, all of Abercrombie's work. Like, that's some of our favorite work, maybe our favorite work in the whole genre. And so then it's like, and this other book was good. So it's
and you don't, let's be honest, like, big, I compared it to a Sander Lynch, but Sanderson can sometimes write to a formula so much that it takes away from the character work, right? So there's no one size fits all here. And I think you touched on it, Dylan. It's Crystal Matar has the writing chops, and she's just so intimately aware of her characters that she can write anything, that these characters can do anything. She doesn't need to stick to like rising action, falling action, climax, you know, like she doesn't have to necessarily strictly follow that, like act one, act two, act three. It's just, here's the characters and they go, and they could do anything and I would be invested, and it would be serving a theme, and it would be building their relationship complexity, and like I'm all for that. Like, this what makes this book great, and I will eagerly, you know, the second book is, you know, out already, came out last year, Brick, The Legacy of Brick and Bone, which I'm would, you know, I want to read soon because I'm a big fan of Crystal as an author. So that's not to say that this is like a huge criticism or anything. It's like she did everything right, and I just wanted more. You know, that's a good criticism to receive as an author.
It's okay to say she didn't. Yeah, I mean, it's okay to not feel she did everything right. And could the ending have had a little more oomph to it? I'm sure. But it's, it is in the vein, it feels like, of the Blade itself kind of ending, where I wouldn't be surprised if after we've read this full series, we're saying the same kind of thing we say about the First Law, like original trilogy, in the sense of this is one complete story. And if you want to read that first book and get the, like, this is a standalone with sequel potential type experience, you don't get as much as you will with some other books. Like, I would say, you know, we always go to Sanderson so quick as the example of just, like, following the rules of storytelling to a T and executing in that way. And, yeah, like, Mistborn does very much follow that, like, rising action, climax, falling action, like, as its own individual book. And I feel very good recommending Mistborn, The Final Empire, which is book one, as you will get a complete reading experience just reading this book. And you'll probably really love it because this is a super popular book and it's accessible to so many people. But if for some reason you don't, you will not feel like this is unfinished if you don't go on and see what happens with all those plot hooks that Sanderson gave us little hints of where things are going. Well, this, if you just read Legacy of the Brightwash and you never carry forward with the trilogy, I would totally understand a feeling of it like this feels unfinished. And that's okay with a trilogy. Or is it a trilogy? Is that the plan?
No, I'm not sure. It only shows the two, and it doesn't show another one, like, in the works. Tainted Dominion is the name of the series, and it's got two books out right now. No, like, placeholder for a third, but I'm sure there'll be more. I mean, this world is so rich that she could write anything. You know, there's something called Tainted by Crystal Matar, but it doesn't say it's... It says it's in the series. Let's see what this is. It's something different. But, it's like I said, I'm now officially a big fan of Crystal Matar, and I'm very impressed by her abilities as an author, and I can't wait to read more, essentially. And, you know, there was a lot that I really enjoyed about the book. So, definitely one of those things where she's got two books out right now. Like, the bigger her library is, like, and the more we can enjoy it and the more she writes as she goes, I think we're in for a lot of really great reads. And I'm looking forward to her trajectory as an author and where it goes, because she's got, you know, so much success already and still what I feel like so much potential as well. So I'm just super excited about the series as a whole and where it's going to go, and big fan of Legacy of the Brightwash on its own as well.
Yeah, totally agree, Charles. Well said. Feel like we've said our piece on this. So
I think so.
I'm willing to move forward on that. I'm willing to get that sweet, sweet outro music pumping.
Yeah, I agree. Let's get that sweet, sweet outro music going. Thank you all, one and all, for listening to yet another very exciting episode of the Friends Talking Fantasy Podcast. podcast. If you like what you heard today, if you want to support the show, do that by following and engaging with us over on social media. That's at the FTF Podcast on Instagram and TikTok, and at the FTF Podcast with the number one at the end on Twitter. Now, Dylan, if they like what they heard today and they want to support the show even more than engaging with us over on social media, what can they do?
Toss 5 stars to our podcast, which you can do over on Spotify, where most of you are listening. Right now, the way you do that is you click about, then you click where the stars are, and throw us 5 of those. You can also rate and review on Apple Podcasts. That means you can write nice things about us. If you do happen to go on the TikTok and you get to see Charles's fresh new haircut, I mean, how could you resist the urge to write about that in a review? Just say 5 stars for the haircut. I mean, I didn't even listen to the episode, but I saw that TikTok video, and this is a man who deserves 5 stars. I mean, this guy could play Tashue Blackwood, if you know what I'm saying, with that fresh new cut. I mean, but younger, of course.
Maybe I could play the son, you know, the guy in the rift there, Jason, you know?
Jason?
It's like, so much power.
Is Jason, is Jason described as having an amazing haircut? I think he's probably not. He's
they probably aren't giving out fresh cuts in the rift, but you never know.
Anyway, you don't have to rate and review, although the temptation will be great if you see Charles's hair. Just listening is more than enough. Thank you so much for doing that.
Just listening, guys, as Dylan said, more than enough. You guys are awesome for making it all the way to the end. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And as always, go forth and conquer, friends.